Times this hour. Palestinians condemn as provocative Israel's plan for the construction of hundreds of new settler units in the occupied West Bank. Saudi warplanes launch fresh airstrikes on the Yemeni capital Sana'a, leaving several casualties and material damage. And Dutch officials say 61 COVID cases have been found among people who flew from South Africa, amid concerns about the spread of a new variant of the virus. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Palestinian Authority has condemned Israel for approving the construction of 372 new settler units in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the plan is provocative and is an extension of the Israeli process of expanding settlements in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. The new project includes homes, commercial buildings, and educational institutions. Israel has built thousands of settlements on occupied Palestinian land over the past years as part of its land grab policy. All Israeli settlements on the occupied Palestinian land are illegal under international law. Earlier, we talked to Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutab to get his thoughts on the issue. He says Israel's continued settlement activities in the occupied West Bank are a slap in the face of the international community.
And one of the last decisions done by the United Nations Security Council during the Obama-Biden administration was Resolution 2334, which made it illegal to build and to expand and continue building illegal settlements in the West Bank. The idea that settlements continue at a time when the Israeli government is publicly saying we don't want to have negotiations, there's not going to be any solution to the conflict, is a slap in the face of the international community.
Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip have expressed their anger at the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs' visit to Morocco. They described the visit as a stab in the back of Palestinians. Ruba Shavit has more from the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip expressed their anger at the security pact signed between Israel and Morocco, describing it a betrayal that eroded their leverage with Israel. The agreement is part of the first official visit by Benny Gantz to one of the Arab states that normalized ties with the regime last year, provoking wide outrage among Palestinians.
This is a stab in the back of our Palestinian cause and the Arab and Islamic nations. This visit of Benny Gantz to Morocco gives Israel a green light to go further with the new crimes. All Palestinian factions refuse this move and totally condemn normalizing ties with Israel. We stress that no ties can give Israel any right in our lands, as it will remain our enemy.
Palestinians say governments that have normalized ties with Israel do not represent their people.
This is really disappointing. Welcoming Benny Gantz in Morocco is a betrayal for Palestinians. He killed our children and launched conflicts in Gaza. Instead of welcoming him in Arab countries, he should have been held accountable for his crimes and delivered a punishment for killing our people. We call on Moroccan people to voice louder to end the ties with Israeli regime.
Meanwhile, Moroccans took to the streets in front of the parliament building in Rabat, condemning Gantz's visit to Morocco. The demonstration was suppressed by the police.
Our brothers and sisters in Morocco always support us. We don't blame the people for what their government is doing. We call on Moroccan people to protest against these ties that mainly aim at silencing Palestinians' voice and giving Israel a permission to commit more and more of crimes in the region. All Arab and Islamic nations should stand against the normalization of ties with Israel and support Palestinians in their struggle.
Morocco, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan signed agreements to normalize relations with Israel in 2020 as part of the so-called Abraham Accords, which were brokered by administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. The recent visit of Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, to Morocco has angered Palestinians. They consider ties between Israel and Morocco as a green light to the Israeli regime to press ahead with its crimes in the region. Palestinians call on Arab nations to stop their governments from normalizing ties with Israel, calling it a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The Salida coalition has carried out fresh airstrikes on the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Our correspondent Abdel Latif al-Washali says that there has been an unknown number of casualties as well as material damage.
Saudi Arabia has been escalating its attacks on civilians on the residential areas in the capital city in Sana'a. They are pushing the Yemeni army to keep pressing ahead, to keep attacking the Saudi facilities. The Saudi planes have launched yesterday two airstrikes on Al Mahdain area. They have been almost launching airstrikes every day during the past months, and this will absolutely push the Yemeni army to respond to the Saudi attacks. It is the right of the Yemeni army to respond to the Saudi attacks, as Yemenis are depending on the army to push and to force the kingdom to stop these attacks against civilians. Most of the casualties of these attacks are only children and women. They are killing the Yemeni people for the seventh year. So I believe that the Yemeni army will be responding in the few coming days to these Saudi attacks and will be pushing the Saudi regime to stop its attacks on civilians.
The new COVID-19 variant, now known as Omicron, seems to have found its way to Europe. In the Netherlands, health officials have announced the detection of 61 coronavirus cases among people who have flown from South Africa. The Dutch Health Ministry says the cases have been discovered from among 600 passengers arriving in the capital, Amsterdam. The ministry says all the COVID-positive passengers are now in quarantine. It has not known whether the passengers are infected with the new highly infectious strain of the virus first detected in southern Africa. Separately, Germany says the Omicron variant of the virus has probably arrived in the country's state of Hesse. German health officials say that they have found the mutation in a traveler coming back from South Africa. Detlef Ganten is the founding president of the World Health Summit, who joins us. When you take a look at this variant, first, as new as it is, tell us why the alarm is spreading at the rate that it is. First of all, what is different between this and the previous, COVID-19, so we can at least see what the difference lies here?
The acoustics are not so well. I imagine you asked me about the new variant and what we have to expect from that.
Yes.
So as WHO has already stated, and of course we as scientists all agree that this is a cause of concern, but it was not unexpected that there are new mutations coming up. Problem is, and the question is, how aggressive this new variant is and how it will act clinically and how sick the people will become from this, whether it's more serious than the other one. And the other question, of course, is whether the vaccination, the immunization against the previous variant, Corona variant Delta, is effective against the new variant. This is not known so far. So as WHO stated, it is a matter of concern, but the science now is much better than it was 2 years ago. We know much more about the virus. We know much more about the immune system, how it reacts. We know more how to treat the patients. So yes, we have to be very careful. Of course, we in Europe, we and in other countries, we are careful that people who are infected with the new variant, Omicron variant, do not come to the countries and they are isolated in quarantine, and we observe how the clinical symptoms develop and how they respond with the immune system. So we have to be very careful, we have to observe that, but I don't think there is a reason for scare and panic at the present time. Be careful, observe the situation, and be ready for the worst, of course, but also take the hygienic measures as we did before, and don't overreact.
Okay, well, given the fact that you're a specialist in your field, from what I understand, if you can tell us what the pharma industry and the big pharma companies are going to have to deal with. I mean, one place that I read, it said that they have to take the vaccine that is currently available and modify it in order to deal with this particular variant, and that that is actually normal when you're talking about
different times. I do not hear.
Yeah, is that the case? Is that what needs to happen?
It may be that we have to modify the vaccine, and actually, I'm well aware of BioNTech was one of the leaders in the preparation of vaccines, the BioNTech vaccine, and they're already working on it. And we first, of course, have to see whether the old vaccine is as effective for the new variant or not. This we need to investigate, takes some time, but we are already getting ready to organize a new vaccine with the new RNA technology. It will be easier actually to prepare a new vaccine than with the classical methods. So I think we are on the way, we are well prepared for anything which can happen, but now it's time for science. And as you may know, we have established a WHO hub for pandemic and epidemic intelligence here in Berlin, getting all the data together on behalf of WHO, analyzing these data with scientists around the world, and have international coordination on the direction and what to do best in the near future.
Well,
and make recommendations, of course, for the international population and politicians.
Sure. Well, what you're saying sounds like it's going to be somewhat time-consuming, that a lot of time is going to pass before we get to the stage where you have the vaccine brought up to a level where it's going to deal with this variant. Are we looking at weeks, months, or what are we looking at here, if you're able to answer that?
Well, I think if we need a new vaccine, which we do not know yet, it may be that the old vaccines are as efficient as for the new variant. But if we need a new vaccine, I think the preparation goes much faster because we have the experience. So I think within weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, we will know what needs to be done. And then the new vaccine can be probably ready within a couple of weeks later. And then, of course, the experience with the new vaccine, again, takes time because we have to observe the patients who are vaccinated with respect to their clinical reactions. So not everything can be done within short time, but the science is ready and we can act much, much faster than before.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you for giving us your time. Detlev Ganten, founding president of the World Health Summit there. We appreciate it. Well, thousands of people have marched across Australia's east coast to protest against mandatory coronavirus vaccinations. Protesters again gathered in front of Victorian Parliament in Melbourne, as well as in Hyde Park in Sydney, and at beaches in Brisbane. The anti-vaccination rallies have continued for weeks in Australia, becoming occasionally violent. The anti-vaccination movement, however, remains small, with polls showing nationwide opposition in the single digits. While nationwide vaccinations are voluntary, states and territories have mandated vaccinations for many occupations, barring the unvaccinated from activities like dining and concerts. Japan is planning to boost its military might. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida says that he is seeking to create a strong self-defense force to protect the country against foreign threats.
I've made instructions to revise the National Security Strategy, National Defense Program Guidelines, and Medium-Term Defense Program Plans. Among them, we will consider all options, including possessing the capability to attack so-called enemy bases, to strengthen our defense power that is necessary.
Kishida was speaking at an annual ceremony in the capital, Tokyo, for reviewing the country's armed forces. Kishida has expressed concern about North Korea's ballistic missile tests. He's also referred to mounting tensions with China and its military buildup in the region. The Japanese government has recently approved plans to add over $6 billion to its annual military spending. Tokyo says the move aims to bolster the country's air and maritime defensive capabilities. Political commentator Jason Unruhe, without mentioning Japan, says the U.S. is using other countries as proxies to gain influence in that region amid escalating tensions between China and Japan.
We are very aware that the United States is an empire in decline. China is an empire in the middle of its rise. The United States is going to take whatever measures that it feels would be successful in trying to contain China's growth. And one of that is the current battle over the South China Sea. I mean, there's resources there. There's particularly oil, and I think we all know how important oil is to the global economy and to the petrodollar, et cetera. The United States, by contrast, has funneled money into military production for other countries, which would be used to posture against China. What we're seeing is kind of an east-west kind of situation in a fight over resources. Now, this is nothing new. This can go back many centuries, taking on different forms. But that's essentially what we're seeing right now, is that we're seeing a race for the resources that exist underneath the South China Sea. And the two different ways in which the opposing sides have chosen to race for those resources, and the United States, being that it holds no territory anywhere close to that area, is using other countries as proxy forces to try to intimidate China and, through their proxies, gain some money, influence, etc., by having access to those resources.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Palestine is the main indicator to show the unity of Muslims.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 24, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
Another point is that the main indicator to show the unity of Muslims is the issue of Palestine. The issue of Palestine is an indicator. If Muslims' unity is realized, the Palestine issue will definitely be resolved in the best possible way. The more serious we are on the Palestine issue and work to regain the right of the Palestinian people, the closer we come to the unity of Muslims. In this recent issue of normalizing relations, where unfortunately some governments made a mistake, they made a big mistake. They sinned by normalizing relations with the usurpers, despotic Zionist regime. This move is against Islamic unity and solidarity. They should return from this path and compensate for this grave mistake. Well, these points were about Islamic unity. These were the two points that I wanted to discuss regarding various aspects of the international Islamic community.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Iranian people follow the lead of the Holy Prophet. As for issues related to our own country, although our opponents, the enemies of religion, and those who follow the U.S. ruled over our country for many years, the people have always been believers. Praise God, the Iranian nation has been like this for a long time. Today, more than ever, we consider ourselves to be the followers of the Prophet. Well, what form does this following take, you may ask? Please pay attention to the words following. It means following someone's lead and moving after him. Well, how should we move? The Quran has specified this. You have indeed in the Messenger of Allah a beautiful model of conduct for anyone whose hope is in Allah and the final day. Quran chapter 33, verse 21.
And a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Intense fighting continues between Ethiopian government troops and Tigrayan rebels. Ethiopians recently held a rally in support of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's government. The demonstrators also condemned foreign powers and their media outlets, especially the United States, for supporting the rebels. They rejected U.S. demands that the government halt talks with the TPLF rebels.
They want to destroy our country like they did Afghanistan. They will never succeed. We are Ethiopians. We are children of Adwa. With which TPLF are we going to negotiate? The one that killed and raped us? One that stabbed our mothers and fathers with combat knives? We will never, ever negotiate with them.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program which gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on the security crisis in Ethiopia amid reports that the United States is backing rebels planning to topple the government there. In the second part of our show, we take stock of the recently concluded UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow to see if there was any benefit for the African people who are suffering due to carbon dioxide emissions from industrialized countries, especially in the West. So stay with us till the end of our show.
Ethiopia crisis and U.S. meddling. November last year, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed sent troops into Tigray to topple the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, which was the ruling party in the autonomous region. The Prime Minister justified the move and said it was in response to corruption and human rights violations.
The federal government had every right to deploy federal security forces and use force in order to apprehend those implicated in massive corruption and gross human rights violation.
Meanwhile, the African Union High Representative for the Horn of Africa, Olusegun Obasanjo, addressed the United Nations Security Council via video link and said the warring parties agree on the need for a political solution.
All these leaders here in Addis Ababa and in the North agree individually that the difference between them are political and require political solution through dialogue. This, therefore, constitutes a window of opportunity.
Now, for more on the unfolding situation in Ethiopia and foreign meddling in the conflict, my colleague contacted Dr. Mohamed Hassan, an Ethiopian historian and former diplomat. He is currently the advisor to the president of the Somali regional state in Ethiopia. Dr. Hassan started by briefly stating the main agenda of the TPLF rebels and what exactly they are pursuing in this conflict. Let's take a listen.
In all this time, the United States and European Union was behind the TPLA because they consider when the TPLA is in power in Ethiopia that it is their surrogate regime. TPLA does what the United States wishes and European Union wishes. Or their major objective is that to remain in power and become an agent of the external power. As you know, that Ethiopia is today is about 110 million. Since Prime Minister Abiy came to power, and finally, as the West says, that one of the parameters they consider a democratic country is it has to organize an election. And it was election was organized, and Dr. Abiy was elected overwhelmingly, he and his party. So finally, now, with the support of external forces, they entered and waging in the other provinces of Ethiopia, and I will assure you that the Ethiopian people now, they are highly organized, mobilized to defend their country. And I'm very sure that in short time period, or in a short period, these bandits and this surrogate element.
On the 7th of November, tens of thousands of Ethiopians fled to defend the capital from rebels during a pro-government rally in Addis Ababa. Now, the demonstrators also denounced the United States government for backing the TPLF rebels. Addressing the Mahamoth rally, Addis Ababa mayor stressed that Ethiopians reject a puppet government.
They were electing their leaders democratically, but they tell us we have to get their approval for us to form a government. They are even showing us their wish of putting on us a puppet government. That will never succeed and will never happen here.
Ethiopians have condemned the United States and other foreign actors for meddling in their country. So the question many are asking is, why are external powers interfering in Ethiopia?
These forces which you are asking me, it is United States and Europe. There is nobody else. These are the forces who doesn't want us, we in the Horn of Africa, to have peace, to work together, and to change the life of our population. We have no border with these people. They are very far away from us, more than 10,000 kilometers of Europeans and United States. Maybe it will be 30,000 kilometers. But they wanted to dominate African people, and they wanted to loot the African resources. But that is gone. That time is gone.
Ethiopians also protested against Western media outlets, especially BBC and CNN, that are exaggerating the advances by TPLF rebels. A journalist working for Sputnik News in Addis Ababa has debunked the fake news being disseminated by Western media regarding the current situation in Ethiopia. He spoke to a local TV station during the anti-US rally in Addis Ababa.
The reports that most Western media are putting out are not accurate. The Western media, for many reasons, are supporting the TPLF and talking about a security situation in Addis Ababa that's not accurate. Addis Ababa right now is peaceful, with tens of thousands of people coming out to Meskel Square in support of the Ethiopian government, in support of the democratically elected and legitimate government of Ethiopia. And I've had a wonderful stay and met so many wonderful people here while I've been in Addis.
Dr. Hassan says TPLF has been getting all-out support from Western countries, including favorable media coverage.
These are a bunch of thieves who have stolen more than $40 billion from the Ethiopian people, and they also always live by a life support machine and oxygen foods given for them from United States and Europe. And they support these thugs by satellite, support them by diplomacy, support them by putting propaganda in order to weaken the Ethiopians, that it is, whether it is CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, all their imperialist media hung gang up against Ethiopia and also the government of Dr. Abiy.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been leading efforts for regional integration in the Horn of Africa. Speaking last year during the opening of Kenya's new megaport in Lamu, he said regional integration is the only way to survive in a competitive world.
Without economic integration, there is no way that we can survive in 21st century, just like in 20th century. That's very difficult for us, so we have to work hand in hand to change the life of our citizens. Also, we can easily transform Horn of Africa as long as each government is dedicated their time and resource to invest on infrastructure like my brother did here in Kenya.
Abiy Ahmed's initiative of regional integration in the Horn of Africa is certainly contrary to the imperialist policy of divide and rule. We asked Dr. Hassan if this initiative has been successful.
This idea, the new Horn of Africa, it is 70 years ago it came up through the struggle of the people there and the struggle of Eritrean people and so on. This concept, it is not today, it just came. It is an old and so on, to liberate the region from the clash of external forces. Once that the external forces' hand is weakened or removed, then the contradiction among the people there can be resolved democratically, and the states can work together. And this is what it frightens the imperialist forces. If all these countries can unite and work together and minimize their contradiction, they have a very huge resources and they have a huge human resources, and if they can mobilize that, then they can improve the life of their population and they can bring a safe region and a safe neighborhood.
Ethiopia is said to have some of the largest deposits of natural gas compared to most countries in Africa. Despite all this potential, natural gas has not been properly exploited yet. Despite having vast natural resources in the country, Ethiopia is so much dependent on foreign aid, which is often used as a pressure tool by foreign powers. So what could be the reason behind this state of affairs?
Because of the previous ruling class themselves, they are agents and dependent of the external forces. They don't stand for the interest of their own people, they stand for the interest of external forces. That is why the country became dependent. That is why is that Dr. Abiy, he changed the course and of the country, and he says we can work together, we can develop together, we can make peace in the region, and that is what it's like.
The government of Ethiopia has laid out conditions for possible talks with the rebels, including a halt to attacks, a TPLF withdrawal from the neighboring areas of Amhara and Afar, and recognition of the government's legitimacy. Now we finally asked Dr. Hassan his take on the future of the ongoing conflict in Ethiopia.
The imperialists and the imperialist multinationals, they cannot dominate us and they cannot exploit our resources. And that is the main struggle today. By supporting an internal enemy, a surrogate, a backward of the Middle Ages mentality, in order in the name of Tigrayan people, they want to promote their interest and overthrow the government of Dr. Abiy. But that is not possible. Ethiopians, about 110 million, they are united with him, and they will fight and defend their national sovereignty. I repeat for you, they will fight and defend their national sovereignty. Ethiopia has been tested several times by external forces or by surrogate forces, but it prevailed. And now the ruling class is becoming to a certain extent patriotic, and wants to defend the national interest. And this national interest is muqaddas. It cannot be touched. It is holy.
Well, there you have it, Dr. Mohamed Hassan, an Ethiopian historian and former diplomat, says Ethiopians will continue defending their national interests. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time. Now, we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall look into the recent climate change summit in Glasgow, Scotland, and the death of Western countries all to Africa. Stay with us.
Climate change and the West debt to Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
During the recent 2021 United Nations Climate Change Conference, more commonly referred to as COP26, held in Glasgow, several African leaders spoke to demand climate justice. After 2 weeks of deliberations, few of their requests feature in the final agreement announced on the 13th of November.
Although Africa has contributed the least to climate change, is already experiencing devastating climate impacts and will bear the brunt of future global warming. Speaking before the start of the climate summit in Glasgow, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke on what developed countries need to do to compensate African countries.
We want your more developed economies that have been responsible for the greatest emissions in the world to be the ones who will live up to the offers that they have made in the past, the offers to help the transition by more developing economies, by offering the assistance, the mitigation, the money, and the grants, as well as concessional funding.
For more on the burning issue of climate change, we contacted Nimo Basay, an environmental activist, author, and director of Health of Mother Earth Foundation. And before we go to our guest, let's take a listen to President Lazarus Chakwera of Malawi when he spoke at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow.
When the nations we lead ask, what exactly is the point of this conference? What they are really asking is this. What is the point of having you go to COP26 on our behalf? If you are going to Glasgow for COP26, should we expect you to come back with real solutions on climate change? Or should we just ask the Scottish government to keep you for good because you are part of the problem?
Now, in view of the remarks by the President of Malawi, we asked Mr. Basay his opinion on the Glasgow summit and what benefit, if any, did African countries get from the conference.
Strictly speaking, it can be said that African nations don't really benefit from going to the Conference of Parties, particularly considering the outcome of COP26. Many of the COPs have added up over time to place more burdens on vulnerable countries, vulnerable regions like Africa. And anything that lifts up, that presents 1.5 degrees Celsius as temperature increase target, is actually unfair to Africa. What do our leaders get by going to the Conference of Parties? They go there for technical assistance, for financial assistance. They are not getting any of that.
In another part of his speech during the Glasgow Climate Change Conference, Malawi's president said industrialized countries are not doing African countries a favor by funding projects aimed at climate change mitigation. Let's take a listen.
We must answer them with a needed disbursement of the money pledged to least developed countries by developed nations, which is not a donation, but a cleaning fee.
Several African countries are suffering from disasters such as drought and floods due to extreme weather patterns caused by long-term global climate change. What's the responsibility of big emitters of carbon dioxide, especially the United States, in this regard?
The basic principles of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is anchored on justice and captured as common but differentiated responsibilities. In other words, although global warming is general, some people are more responsible for the other. That does not mean just accepting the fact that they've created this problem, but also accepting responsibility. And that means stopping the increase of greenhouse gas to the atmosphere and also providing the funds to build adaptation, to build resilience, and to help those who are already being drowned in floods, who are suffering from droughts, who are having food issues, famines, and all kinds of negative impacts. Africa is not responsible, but Africa is suffering the impacts.
Despite its low contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, Africa remains the most vulnerable continent to climate change impacts. Now, why is Africa vulnerable to climate variability and change compared with many other regions?
Africa is more vulnerable to climate variability and change compared with many other regions because of her geographical location. The equator passes through almost the middle of Africa. And this means that a very big chunk of Africa's landmass is more or less on the hotspot. Then Africa is totally surrounded by water body, by oceans and the Mediterranean Sea. Global warming is leading to higher warming of the oceans. So that's giving us more cyclones, more deadly cyclones like what has been hitting the southeastern coast of Africa. And the temperature increases much more on African continent than elsewhere. In fact, it is said that Africa suffers about 50% more temperature increase than the global average.
A 26-year-old climate and environmental activist from Kenya, Elizabeth Wathuti, addressed the world leaders at the Glasgow conference and said sub-Saharan Africa is in danger.
I have seen with my own eyes three young children crying at the side of a dried-up river after walking 12 miles with their mother to find water. Please open your hearts. This is not only happening in Kenya. Over the past few months, there have been deadly heat waves and wildfires in Algeria and devastating floods in Uganda and Nigeria. And there is more still to come. By 2025, in just 4 years' time, half of the world's population will be facing water scarcity. And by the time I'm 50, the climate crisis will have displaced 86 million people in sub-Saharan Africa alone.
The future looks quite bleak. So what urgent action is required to avert disasters in African countries affected by natural disasters caused by climate change?
Many of the pledges made by nations is about achieving certain levels of carbon greenhouse emission reduction by 2050, by 2060, by 2070, and all are based on nationally determined contributions, which is what would be convenient for politicians to do way down the road. We don't have 30 years to wait before action is taken. We don't have 40 years to wait. The problem is now, and the action is needed to be taken now. And so what should be done to help Africa is to follow the science. Stop searching for new fossil fuel resources. Stop digging for coal. Stop drilling for oil. Stop drilling for gas. We could tolerate African nations having a little more time for the transition, but the rich, powerful nations who have contributed to the crisis, to the global crisis, should transit immediately from dependence on fossil fuels. They have the resources, they have the technology, and they can do it. We don't have to work on continue depending on a destructive energy regime just because it's convenient for fossil fuel industries.
African rainforests take carbon from the atmosphere and produce oxygen, and thus they are often referred to as the lungs of the world.
Western countries that are leading emitters of carbon dioxide are involved in depleting these forests through logging and industrial farming. Now, do Western countries merely pay lip service when they claim to care for the environment?
We don't see that happening. What we're seeing is manipulation of climate negotiation documents to give leeway for industrialized nations to deploy technologies, unproven technologies, like geoengineering technologies, which they now refer to as intervention kind of technologies, climate intervention, which would mean solar radiation management, means depending on carbon capture and storage. It also means depending more on carbon trading and so-called carbon offsetting. So rich countries will continue to pollute and pay for forests, displaced communities who depend on forests, and claim that the carbon that they're emitting, the equivalent of the carbon they're emitting, is captured by the forests in Africa or somewhere. And so as long as industrialized nations continue to pull the strings in climate discussions, as long as they continue to push towards new unproven technologies as solutions to global warming, it means they are entrenching business as usual, entrenching the use of fossil fuels. They are not in any way driving the world in the direction of renewable, safe, clean energy, and safe food. This is tragic.
While Nimo Basedia believes that the recent climate change conference in Glasgow will have no positive impact and it's business as usual, what's your opinion? Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It was great having you. Goodbye for now and God bless you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, The Man Who Changed the World. I'm your host, Sayyid Jabbari, here with our guest speaker, Mehdi Turabi, who is an expert and researcher. And today we're going to be talking about how the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, during his speech on the anniversary of the passing of the late Imam Khomeini, was saying that as the late Imam got older, he became more revolutionary. And what are your thoughts on that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, I think this itself is a very interesting point. Because usually we think that people getting older, they get mellower and, you know, they...
kind of went in reverse.
Right, they kind of get very cautious and, you know. And like everything else with Imam, may God bless his soul, it wasn't like that. Imam was a very special kind of person. He, from his youth until the last moment he was alive, he was a very special person. And what I mean with very special is that you could see he was always in God's presence. Like, whatever words he said, whatever, you know, the way he would, his body language, decisions that he would make, whether it's personal, in his personal life, or whether it's as the leader of a nation, or as the leader of a revolution. And this continued for the rest of his life. It wasn't something that when he got to a certain age, then he reverted back to some sort of a... You know, we see this happening with people when they get older, a lot of them, is that they, for whatever reason, and, you know, it's in the Quran, it talks about how, you know, we give you aql and then we take it away from you at some point, which happens to a lot of older people in terms of their mental capabilities. But we also see them, you know, becoming a more emotional, becoming maybe... a little bit more...
kind of reverting more to, like, childhood.
Exactly. And then with Imam, we see that this wasn't the case. And the older he got, the more... Because, you know, remember, when the revolution happened, he was 80.
Yeah.
80 years old when the revolution happened. So by the time he passed away, he was 90. He was 89.
Yeah.
He's getting close to 90. So he was an old man. But fully there... making the decisions that he had to make, and becoming more revolutionary. As
more
time.
Sharper, more
right.
Precise.
So let me just read what the Supreme Leader said. This is the English translation. This is the Supreme Leader talking about Imam Khomeini. Even in the last few days of his life, nobody noticed any signs of despair, doubt, exhaustion, weakness, or submission in the words and actions of our magnanimous Imam. Many revolutionaries throughout the world start to have doubts and become conservative as they grow older. Sometimes they even take back their main statements. The statements that were issued by Imam during the last few years of his life were sometimes even more strongly worded and revolutionary than his statements in the year 1342, which is the year that his movement to overthrow the Shah began, about 15 years before the revolution. He was growing old, but he was young at heart, and his soul was vibrant. This is the same steadfastness that has been described in the Holy Quran, and that if they should keep to the right way, we would certainly give them to drink of abundant water. This is an ayah from the Quran. In another ayah, Allah the Exalted says, as for those who say, our Lord is Allah, then continue in the right way, in the right path. The angels descend upon them, saying, fear not, nor be grieved, and receive good news of the garden which you were promised. So, he talks about the fact that these three beliefs of Imam kept Imam young and vibrant. And these three beliefs were faith in God, faith in the people, and faith in himself, in the sense that, you know, being self-confident in some of the decisions you make and not wavering. So I think what's important to point out is that, you know, this is related to the revolution itself. and what the Supreme Leader talks about a lot, which is that, you know, we've had many revolutions, a lot of them even in the Third World, where after a couple of years they just
fall and crumble.
Right. Because, you know, one of the reasons is because they don't, the main reason is because they're not centered on Allah and God.
Hmm.
They use ideologies which don't have a firm,
grounding,
stable
base.
Grounding. Then the second part, which is related to the three beliefs that he's talking about, they're not people's revolutions.
Exactly.
They're elites. Whether it's officers of the army, whether it's a party, whether it's like economic elites, they're not based in the people. The people aren't the ones really doing the revolution. You have
basically coups.
Right. And or you have elite movements, which then the people are pulled.
Like trading one dictator for another.
Right. But in Iran and in the revolutionary era, this wasn't the case. It was it was truly a people's revolution. It wasn't.
It
wasn't
went from being a, you know, a monarchy system with a Shah that was around for what 2,000 years, 2,500 years,
right,
to being actually a republic and actually a democratic system where people could elect their own style of government. You know, after
exactly.
the revolution, they said, okay, what kind of government do you want? You want a communist government? You want a religious government? What kind of government?
Exactly.
You want? They said, okay, we want a religious government. Okay,
exactly.
Elect a president now.
Exactly. And this is very this is very important to point out that we immediately we had elections and we had constitutional Congress after the revolution.
Like, not only were the people allowed to decide who they wanted for, like, president, but they were allowed to decide what kind of government they wanted. Even,
right.
like, within the other societies, like,
and
communist Russia
exactly.
or China, people didn't decide that they wanted this system.
Exactly.
Of
it was a party.
Country.
Like, in China, it was the Communist Party.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have 50 million members of the Communist Party in a country of almost 2 billion.
Yeah.
So that's actually not big. We say 50 million, but that's actually a tiny part of the Chinese population.
Small percentage.
And let me just point out another thing, which is that according to Islamic law, the wali al-faqih, can decide what kind of government he wants to form, the shape of it. So in the absence of the imams, of the masoom, the wali al-faqih has the sovereignty, has the right to establish a government. And about its shape, you know, it's up to him. And as you may recall, we had what was called the Revolutionary Council after the revolution, before we had the interim government. We basically had a council appointed by Imam, you know, of clerics, being and some non-clerics in the beginning as well. They were the Revolutionary Council, which happens in a lot of revolutions.
Yeah.
You will have a revolution, and then a Revolutionary Council is appointed to govern as an executive. And what ends up happening in a lot of revolutions is that Revolutionary Council becomes permanent.
Exactly.
Right?
They're like, okay, I got comfortable. I'm not going anywhere.
Right.
They start putting down roots.
Right. So you saw, for example, you had in Egypt, you had the military council.
Yeah. And now they don't want to go anywhere.
Right. You had in some of the revolutions in the 50s and 60s, you had these military councils ruling the Arab countries. Okay. So Imam, technically speaking, from a fiqh perspective, could have just said, you know what, this is the Revolutionary Council, let them rule. And, you know, me as the supreme leader, as the wali al-faqih, will give my blessings and that's it. We don't know parliament, no presidency, no local councils,
yeah.
right? He could have done that, but he didn't. He insisted on a republican form of government with elected parliament, with elected executive,